Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and today my guest is Andy Biggio. Andy is a Marine Corps veteran, a police officer, and author of The Rifle. And we're going to discuss his book and the efforts that he's been going through to bring World War II veterans back to Europe where they fought decades earlier. But first, welcome to the show, Andy. I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me. And it's always a good day when you get to start off talking about World War II and everything else. So
it is a good day, right? And, you know, it's a lot of history there and a lot of information from some of these guys that you've been talking to. But before we get into all that, for the listeners who maybe aren't familiar with you and your background, there may be some listeners out there who have heard of you. Maybe the name sounds familiar, either through your book or other interviews that you've done. I know I found out about you through some other interviews that you had done myself. But can you tell the listeners who maybe aren't familiar with you a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. I grew up as a very patriotic kid, like many kids in the 80s and 90s in America. And, you know, both of my grandfather's brothers were killed in World War II. So I grew up kind of learning about that sacrifice very young, at a young age. And grew up in a post 9/11 world where everything was, you know, using dicks and twigs as guns and hide and go seek and playing war games. And then when 9/11 happened, I joined the Marine Corps about 4 years after, because I was still in, you know, school. So I deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. I always wanted to serve my country, regardless of like what the mission was. I just wanted to be the same person my grandfather was in World War II. And I guess I didn't realize how much that was going to shape my life afterwards. I ended up starting my own nonprofit to help wounded veterans coming home. Things that the VA couldn't pay for, like brand new cars and housing modifications. And then when I realized that we were losing 900 World War II veterans a day, I started searching and finding World War II veterans. And the way I did it was very unique and different. And, you know, obviously we'll get into that, but I wanted to say goodbye to America's last World War II veterans before it was too late.
Yeah, and I think that's an important mission, too, because we've talked on this show before about the importance and the power of sharing your stories. And, you know, once when some of these veterans from back in World War II era and even some of the more recent ones, Korea, Vietnam, you know, once when we lose those people, a lot of times their stories go along with them. You know, there wasn't the self-publishing the way we have self-publishing these days, where anyone can write a book and publish it on Amazon. You know, they didn't have those options back then for their stories to kind of outlive them. And so they kind of lived in their minds and in the minds of whoever they told those stories to. But once those people are gone, you know, they're gone, right? And so, you know, the work that you're doing, and yes, we'll get into that in a little bit, but the work you're doing is, I think, is super important to preserve some of those stories from the average Joe who's on the front lines, not the generals and the people like that, right? It's the average guy who is out there fighting for his country.
Absolutely. And I think we've seen that more than ever now with the whole fall of Afghanistan is, you know, that the average Joe was winning the war and then the generals and politicians lose the war. So it's, I think we know who the real responsible guys are. You know, I think it's been made clear more than ever. And to me, the most therapeutic thing I've ever done, not alcohol, not drugs, not therapy sessions, not, you know, any type of prescription. But when I paired a Iraq and Afghanistan veteran with a World War II veteran, it has been the most therapeutic thing ever. Like the younger generations of veterans are just captivated by these old men and what they went through and how they were able to live successful lives after combat, sure. You know, and live up to age 100 and the greatest generation. And that has been so inspirational for our younger veterans.
Well, I want to get more into that in a little bit, but we're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we get back to that, we'll get into that that aspect of pairing those veterans up together. So stay tuned.
Attention military veterans and families. Stand out in the job market with Monster Resume Writing Service. Get a custom resume tailored to your skills and career goals. Check out the link in this episode's show notes for more information.
So, Andy, we were talking a little bit before the break about the benefits of pairing those veterans together to see the Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans and the World War II veterans coming together. And I want to get a little bit more into that. But first, I want to kind of just take a quick step back, because you talked a little bit about the nonprofit work and kind of how you got into doing what you're doing now. And you're the founder of Boston's Wounded Vet Run. And through that nonprofit, you helped raise a ton of money for wounded veterans. Can you tell us about that organization, how that came to be?
Yeah, in 2008, I think, or 7, I was invited to a Red Sox game, and it was like tickets for veterans. And I met a young veteran from the 82nd Airborne. His name was Vincent Mannion, and he had his whole skull replaced with plastic. He was struck by an IED, and he had what was called a bicranial replacement surgery. And I was just devastated and had never seen an injury like that on a young soldier. You know, his brain injury was so bad that he was now basically a 8-year-old in a 30-year-old's body. And I asked the family whatever I could do for them. And they were telling me how the VA at the time wouldn't pay for a new roof of their house. So I said, oh, hell no. I went out and I got a bunch of my friends that rode motorcycles, and we did a motorcycle charity run for him. We raised like 30 grand. And then from there, it just went on every year for 13 years. We picked different veterans to do that motorcycle charity run for. We became a federally chartered nonprofit, and I've raised over a couple $1 million now for like maybe 60 wounded veterans over the last 13 years, giving them every cent. I don't take a salary, none of that. And they've used the money for brand new cars, housing modifications, transportation needs, down payments on houses. And
yeah, that's great, incredible. So. But at some point along the line, you realize that this population that you were talking about earlier of the World War II veterans, that whole generation was dwindling at a pretty rapid rate. And you wanted to find a way to tell those stories of the veterans before it was too late, right? Before they're lost for good. So tell us how you came about that.
Yeah. So, well, at this motorcycle charity run, every now and then I would see a World War II veteran show up. They didn't have a motorcycle or anything, but they just want to come and hand me a check for the wounded soldier or the wounded Marine. And I was just like, wow, here's this guy who's 90 making his way through crowds of motorcycles and people just to hand me a little paper check. And I said, pretty soon there's going to be a day where we don't see that, you know, where I don't see that. So I started to reflect on myself, because I'm named after one of my grandfather's brothers who was killed in World War II, Andrew Biggio. Andrew was killed in Italy with the 34th Division. I started reading his letters that he wrote home before he was killed and how much he enjoyed the M1 rifle, the M1 Grand. So I was like, I need to go out and buy one and feel what he felt and hold what he held. And this is so crazy that this young 19-year-old kid's talking about this rifle. So I went and bought an M1 Grand. And that was the way that I would connect with World War II veterans, by taking that M1 Grand to their house, putting it in their hands and watching their reaction. Them holding that instrument of warfare again after 75 years just brought back so many memories, and we bonded from veteran to veteran. And I got them to talk about a lot of things that they hadn't talked about with anyone in their family, anyone else, because like I said, uniquely, this is the first time you saw the country's youngest generation of veterans saying goodbye to the oldest generation of veterans. There's no real good documentation of that kind of interactions in our history, I don't think. I mean, there is. You'll see a lot of photos of Civil War veterans meeting World War I veterans, World War I veterans meeting Desert Storm veterans. Like, I've seen things like that, but I wanted to document
it. Yeah, it's one thing to meet these people, but to have it documented for future generations to look at this and see the differences, the similarities between the generations and what they all experienced through their service. And you know, I think it's kind of interesting that before the break, you were saying just how impactful it was to pair the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans with the World War II veterans, get them together. And I talk to other veterans these days and, you know, the younger generation of veterans, and they have such a resistance to joining, you know, the VFW or the American Legion or things like that, because it, the mindset is, oh, it's just that the old man's, you know, drinking club, that type of thing. You know, it's a, you know, for the old generations, for the World War II vets, the Korean vets, those types of things. But there's such a powerful impact that could be had there if those two groups of people were to get together, the younger generations and the older generation, and they get together, that could be such a tremendous impact. I'm surprised actually that, you know, it doesn't happen more often.
Yeah. You know, it's the gap, you know, there was a 40-year gap between, Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan. There was a 25-year gap between Vietnam and World War II. And any conflicts we had in between, we were so small that there wasn't millions of veterans involved in them. And so that's why, that's another reason why you see so many American Legion posts and VFW posts that are closing their doors because of that huge gap. you know, the Vietnam vets are all retired in their 70s and now they're looking for the next guys to take over. But we are all in like our early 30s, starting families, having kids that, you know, we can't get down to the VFW every day, you know, and that's really not where you want to be.
If you're starting a family, you got you know, young kids at home, or you're just getting started in your career post-military, spending your time at a VFW or American Legion Hall maybe isn't the place where you want to be, you know, at least not on a, you know, full-time basis where you're going there every night or, you know, even a couple nights a week. But, you know, I think that there's some benefit there to, you know, talking to those guys who've been there, they've done that, they've gone through those transitions that a lot of these younger guys are going through, and they can maybe help out with some of that stuff. And you know, so I see that as a potential benefit. But, you know, there's just so much, you know, such a wealth of knowledge from these veterans that you were talking to. And you mentioned it's, you know, just kind of pairing the two groups of people together. You know, I feel like that is, you know, when you put those two groups together, I feel like you're just combining forces and you're able to get a, you know, just a real powerful impact when you have those two groups of people together and helping each other out. Right.
Yeah. It's, it's been my addiction. It has, it's like the best way to describe it. I wish every young veteran who may find themselves in a meaningless place, a dark place, or just a confused place on what's next, you know, I would love to get them all, like, go down to your local nursing home, go down to your local assisted living place, because there's some 100-year-old or 98-year-old legend in there.
Right. And, you know? And these guys were, you know, bigger badasses way back then. You know, they were.
People reach out to me all the time and they say, how do I meet a World War II veteran? How do you do it? I'm like, and I get a little, or they ask me for contact information of those World War II veterans. And it just aggravates me because I'm finding them right under my own nose in my own neighborhood. And you can too. And you don't worry about the guy that I post on Instagram or Facebook. Go find your own guy because he exists and he probably deserves more attention than the attention I'm giving this particular veteran on social
media. Right. And
that's
true, you know? Because there are, you know, fortunately, there are still some World War II veterans around. It's not like there's none left. And yeah, you can go find the other ones. You've told stories of plenty of them, you know, that you were able to track down. But track down others, because like we were saying earlier, these are the stories of the average Joe who is out on the battlefield doing the grunt work a lot of the times. They all have different stories. You know, they, even if they were in the same battles, they saw things from different perspectives. They did things differently. You know, these things, you know, they can, you know, just pair up with these different stories. And, you can even compare notes from, you know, one veteran who is in, you know, one battle to the other veteran who is in the same battle and see like, okay, what actually went down when this happened. But if you're just talking to just the one guy, you're going to get one perspective. And it's, I think, important to have a lot of different perspectives, especially when you're talking boots on the ground. So
sure.
We're going to take a quick commercial break here. When we get back, I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, this idea of, you know, bringing this rifle around and how it got to, you know, spark some of these conversations. So stay tuned.
Embrace your patriotism with the Patriot Box subscription box service. Join Patriot Box's community of proud Americans. Visit the link in our show notes for more information.
So, Andy, the stories that you were that were told to you while you brought around the M1 rifle to all of these World War II veterans sparked another idea, which I think you were starting to talk about a little bit earlier, but basically to bring some of these veterans back to the battlefields that they fought on in Europe. Tell us about how those trips came to be and what those all look like.
Yeah, you know, I interviewed over 300 veterans, but what I found was consistent with over half of them was they never returned to the battlefields they served on in areas that like are people like our bucket list, Rome, Paris, Amsterdam, and especially as from veterans living on the Northeast. I mean, this is just like a quick 6-hour flight with no stops. And I asked them, you know, why didn't you go back? You know, well, I was starting a family. I was moving all my life and I had not so good memories of that stuff. And then now that that's all over with, now that they're not raising families anymore and they have this young veteran across them. And I asked them the second question, would you go back now? Would you ever go back now? And for them to sit there and go, yeah, you know what? I think I would. I think I'd like to go back. And then I just say, right. Well, let's go, you know, let's go. I'll do a fundraiser and I'll bring you in. I've brought in over 30 World War II veterans back to their battlefields. Over half of them had wow. never been back since the war. To see them walk in the woods, look at their foxholes again for the first time in over 70 years was just amazing. And again, that goes back to their chaperones and the people pushing their wheelchairs were all Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. You know, this is just was a nonstop evolution of, like I said, therapeutic partnerships between young veterans and old veterans. And just to see that these World War II veterans smiling ear to ear and being treated as the liberators they still are, you know, those local Belgian and French and Dutch people view these guys bigger than athletes. I mean, bigger than professional athletes. I mean, they line up on the sidewalk 3 or 4 rows deep just to get a glimpse of a real live World War II.
And that's the kind of reception that you guys were getting when you went over there. How did the Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans who were kind of escorting them and bringing them around places, how did they seem to receive that kind of feedback?
I like to think that they view it as the way I do, that it's kind of like, this is our welcome home too, not just theirs, you know, because it's seeing how much they're appreciated, how much they're celebrated, makes me feel like they're cheering me on too, in a way, you know. And and I've had them come up to me and say, thank you for your service and what you've done for our, you know. And that's so crazy because, you know, you're a Belgian guy living in the woods in rural Belgium, and you know, you're telling me that I helped protect you and I did this, that, and the other thing for your freedom. And that means a lot to me. That means a lot than I think what we get now here in America, where it used to be like, thank you for your service and thank you for protecting us. And now it's just kind of like, oh, are you broken? Is there something wrong with you now? Do you have PTSD? You know?
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
After like 2013 or 14, we stopped seeing this like, thank you for your service. And then it went into a, are you okay type thing.
Yeah. Right. And I think that's important to have those conversations as well. But, you know, the appreciation and, you know, I know when coming back from overseas, the crowds of supporters who are in the airports who were, you know, waving American flags and all that kind of stuff, you know, that stuff has obviously dwindled. The conflicts aren't there the way they were, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so I think the reason why I was asking about the way that the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans received the treatment from the World War II veterans and the local people in the areas that you guys were visiting over in Europe, I think the reason why I was asking about that is because having served in Afghanistan myself, I don't ever envision a day where I'll ever be able to get back to the places where I fought. You know, I don't see that happening anytime in my lifetime. And so in a way, I'm sort of envious of those guys who are able to go back there and get some closure, you know, after the conflict is over, where the people there are appreciative, they're supportive, they're not shooting at them, they're not you know, having to dodge, you know, missiles or anything like that coming their way. And so I was kind of curious to see what did the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans feel about those trips. But I definitely wasn't anticipating that appreciation that they were receiving and the gratitude that they were receiving from the local people as well. You know, it to me, that was, you know, a surprising result, but, you know, in a good way. Definitely a good thing that they were getting that appreciation as well.
I like to think that maybe Afghanistan or Iraq will become the next, friggin' not Abu Dhabi, but, where do all the tourists go?
I'm drawing a blank on the name of it.
They have all the skyscrapers and skydiving and Dubai, you never know, it could become it's too bad, because it's like, well, if the Taliban are in charge, imagine if we left Germany with the Nazis in charge. Like, no, I don't think.
Yeah. And it's just a shame, that you go in all this time, this money, the resources, not only just, military equipment, but personnel that we lost over there or were severely wounded over there. We don't get the nice happy ending where you get to go back and see that all the good that the hard work, put in. But there are places where, so you've taken a bunch of people over to Europe. Are there any plans to make trips over to the Pacific Theater?
There's a foundation there, like as in not like a group foundation, but like a base for us Marines that are trying to do that. But it's just, it's a lot. Like I said, going from Boston to Paris or Boston to Rome or Boston to Amsterdam is a simple 6-7 hour direct flight. Trying to take a Marine who's in his late 90s to go to Saipan, you're talking Boston to Los Angeles, Los Angeles to Hawaii, Hawaii to maybe Tokyo, that's a lot, man. That's a lot. And then on these islands, they're not first world countries where you can just walk into a restaurant, use a bathroom. I mean, like maybe in Okinawa, some parts of Saipan, but like it's just a lot more money, a lot more difficult on the veteran. I don't want to get a veteran sick or not have proper medical attention because we're on a desolate island.
Yeah, that
hopefully try the remains of a pillbox.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't even thought of that. That just the logistics involved. You're going a much further distance and to places that are much more remote as far as medical care goes, and even just basic accommodations, hotels, and things like that are, I'm sure they have those, they're probably not, like what you might expect to find in Paris or Rome or places like that. So, incredible experience. I gotta imagine for the guys who were able to make it back to Europe, and go back into those battlefields and visit the graves of maybe some of their fallen comrades. Any memorable moments that stick out to you from those trips to either the battle sites or anything like that?
I mean, we've had people who survived during the war going up to the veterans saying, do you remember when this happened? Do you remember when that happened? And the veteran saying, yeah, I do. And this was your house. I remember it was destroyed. Like, wow. Mind blowing. I'll never forget. I had one guy named Harvey Siegel. He served with the 2nd Infantry Division. He was field artillery. And they moved into this town in Germany called Hackenfeld, Germany. Hackenfeld. It was a weird name. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong. And they took over this little village, and there was a house that was like a big bed and breakfast, and that's where those guys, they kicked the Germans out, and they moved in there. And we went back to that Hackenfeld, and sure enough, the bed and breakfast was still there. And we knocked on the door, and Harvey's like, no, please don't. I can't. I don't want to see these people. Like, I'm scared. And the grandchildren of those Germans that they kicked out said, yes, we remember when the Americans came and kicked out. Our grandparents would always tell us that story. Come on in. They invited Harvey and me in, gave us beer, showed us the room where he slept. And it was just amazing. Yeah,
that's incredible. And, how these stories get passed on from one generation to another, in their in their world, from the grandparents down to the grandchildren. And I'm sure now those grandchildren are going to say, and then, by the way, that same guy came back all these years later and knocked on the door, and we showed him around and everything. They're going to tell their kids, and those stories are going to continue to live on that way. But also they live on in the book that you wrote as well. And I think that's, even more important, is that you have these stories documented now in a physical form that's going to outlive not only those veterans, but it's going to outlive all of us, because you now have this document in these books. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just really important to be able to have those, to share those with future generations, all those stories.
For sure. I don't regret my journey at all. And God, it's going to be a sad day when they're all gone. And they've become, of 300 of them, a lot of them I've become really close to, I take them grocery shopping, check in on them, play cards with them on Sundays. And, it's more than just sign my rifle and thanks a lot, buddy, and never talk to you again. I'm there for them.
I think them getting that rifle back in their hands and feeling the stock, feeling the metal, feeling everything that they felt all those years ago, it's got to bring back some memories, some emotions, and everything. It definitely probably makes the stories that much better, as opposed to just walking up to them cold and just asking them, hey, tell me about this, tell me about this time in your life. You got to be able to get much better stories out of them when you have that type of, kind of lead in that intro with that type of rifle. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that when we get back, but we're going to cut to a quick commercial break. So stay tuned.
Make a heroic impact with the Hero Company. Support veterans with PTSD by purchasing jewelry, apparel, and more. Visit this episode's show notes or theherocompany.co/drive-on to learn more and be a hero for our heroes.
So, Andy, when you bring these Iraq and Afghanistan veterans along on those trips, they obviously had firsthand experiences with these veterans, these World War II veterans, going back to the battlefields that they fought on, going back to the cemeteries and the other places along those lines. The stories that you have documented now in your book, how do you think that those stories can help out the future generations, the Iraq, Afghanistan veterans, and even future veterans who are going to fight in wars that we don't even know about quite yet?
Yeah, I think it's a story of survival and overcoming. And I think that if these young veterans can see that and read about these average Joes who stormed Iwo Jima, who were captured in the Battle of the Bulge, that they were able to come home and live long, successful lives and have kids and have a career and have a normal life to the most of their ability, that they can too, that we can too. And, it's those guys, and a lot of these veterans, when you open up my book, you'll see that it wasn't just war was black and white, right? It wasn't just we came home and we were heroes and we got parades and that was the end of it. No, like the Greatest Generation did some not so great things to win World War II, and that stuck with a lot of these. Despite what the newspapers were showing, what the media was showing, that we're all heroes and everything is great. The World War II veterans in my book will tell you that the bad things that they had to do and what they suffered and what they saw and how they overcame it. And they don't care how many people were calling them the Greatest Generation, that they suffered some psychological stuff. And I want the younger veterans to see that it wasn't just good versus evil, and the war wasn't, World War II wasn't just black and white, and that a lot of Americans felt guilty and horrible what they did to the Germans and what they did to the Japanese.
And there's that moral injury aspect of it, where you are put into a situation where you might have to do these things that are completely maybe against your moral code. But you're, like you said before, it's a story of survival, and you either do these things or you don't, and you don't survive in some cases. And so, I 100%, I think that these stories need to be told to let people know that they're not alone in the feelings that they have after coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan or some other place in the future, because These stories are very common, where you have people who suffer these psychological issues after combat. And they come back and they figure out a way to bounce back from it and be resilient. Yeah. I think that maybe that's the word to put on this, is it's a story of resiliency, right?
Yeah, for sure. And, I hope people get out there and to meet their own heroes before it's
too late. Absolutely. And you were talking earlier about ways to do that, like places that you can go to find these other veterans. Going to, nursing homes or, your local veterans hospital or, places like that, where these people are going to start congregating. There's going to be more and more of them around these areas. That's a easy, simple way. It's not super hard to find these people. It's not like they're going to be, stuck in the woods in some, cabin somewhere that they're, away from society necessarily, because, they're probably going to be closer to places where they can get the care that they need as they're getting older. Seek these people out. Not all of them are going to want to share their stories, and that's fine. But there's going to be some who do want to share their stories and talk to them. And like you said, help them with their groceries, play cards with them, do things that will, kind of open them up and get them to share their experience and share their time serving our country. Because those stories will be gone before too long. And that would be just a terrible shame, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, you also have another book that's coming out. So your first book, we mentioned earlier, The Rifle, and you have The Rifle 2, which is coming out as well. Could you tell us a little bit about that book?
Yeah, so Rifle 1 was a very great success. And I had collected so many stories, I said, why not make a part 2? So Rifle Volume 2 is coming out September 18th. But this time was a little different. I chose, it's a little bit more controversial. These are a lot of men I met that half the book is full of guys who came home and were not the greatest generation. We got liars. We have alcoholics. We have guys who didn't get honorable discharges, guys that did jail time after the war, guys who tried to commit suicide, So these are all the guys that were swept under the rug by our government. And so not only did they overcome World War II, they came over their personal battles, and then they had a successful life. So these weren't the guys who just came home and flourished. These guys came home, had a rocky, very rocky road, and then were able to flourish. So, this one's basically, the bastards of the battlefield, I call it. And I've had to change a lot of names on this book and things like that to protect the identity of the veterans. And, some of them were stolen valor, okay, that I met. They were such good liars,
Yeah.
So,
And that's, I think, an important part of the story to tell as well, is that not everybody comes home to the parades and the heroes welcome like you see in the newspapers or in the television clips from way back then. You see all of that stuff, and everyone's happy, everyone's smiling, everyone, they're grabbing their girl and they're giving a kiss in the middle of the street, that type of thing. It's like, it's not all that. That's not the whole story. Maybe the only part of the story that's actually being told, because that's the glamorous part of it. That's the part that we want to believe. But just like the current generations have trouble when they get home and they're dealing with some stuff, the generations back then were dealing with some stuff as well. The downside back then is that they didn't have anywhere near the type of support that we have now, as far as mental health and other kind of counseling and support services and things like that. It's kind of like, hey, buddy, go figure it out. You're home now. You did your job. We paid you. We did what we needed to do. Now go back to your life and go figure it out. And that's, I think we all know that's not necessarily the best way to send people back into society, but that's where they were. And, and so, like you said, a lot of these guys ended up getting into some trouble. They end up with, drinking issues, troubles with the law, other issues that they may end up having. And that's the not so sexy side of war. And I think those stories need to be told as well, because people need to know that they're not alone when they're going through some of these things. And when you have these stories out there, it's much easier to share that with people and let them know, no, you're not alone. There are other people, even, even of the greatest generation, there were people who suffered and they struggled, you know? And so it's important.
Yeah.
Yeah,
for sure.
Now, any, you know, kind of interesting stories from that book? I know this episode's going to come out a couple weeks before this book is released, but any interesting stories that you want to share that, that kind of entice some of the listeners to maybe grab a copy when the book comes out?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I brought a fighter pilot, a 100-year-old fighter pilot back to Belgium in Germany, and we located the crash sites of his friends, found pieces of the plane still in the dirt, like the farmers that now reside in this area over the last 30, 40 years when they've been farming, have been digging up pieces of the plane here and there and leaving it in a pile in their shed. And to give these pieces back to the wingman of his partner of Ed Cottrell was the P-47 pilot, and to hand him back pieces of his best friend's plane 78 years later, I mean, it was just amazing. It was amazing. I never thought, like, me as a Marine infantryman could bond with an Air Force guy, and we did. We cried together, we hugged each other, and what we uncovered of his, he lost both of his roommates during the Battle of the Bulge. They were shot down and killed, and to be on the crash site in the area is just amazing with him. And that's one of the first chapters that start off with me and Ed Cottrell, who's now 102, and we're going back again this December to the commemorations in Belgium. So yeah, it's been really good.
And that's great too, that that some of these guys actually get to go back multiple times, not just the one time to go back, because you know, I gotta imagine the first time going back to some of these places is probably somewhat overwhelming, and being able to go back a second time, maybe to take in some of the stuff that maybe you couldn't quite handle or couldn't quite process when you're going there that first time, and it's kind of that shock to your system. But then you sort of get used to it, and you kind of know what to expect when you get there, and you know, it takes a little bit of the anticipation away from it, and then you can maybe fully enjoy the experience of being there. Not to say that the guys who've only gone once didn't enjoy it, but you might, I would imagine you'd probably be able to get more out of that experience by going a second time, or you know, even multiple times after that to really,
which we did,
Those veterans, I got to imagine, did they have any sort of other stories that you want to share that might be, you know, interesting for the listeners?
Well, Scott, you want me to spoil the whole book for you? No, I'm kidding. I think another one, people will be mind blown that I befriended this guy who was so convincing, and we went back to France together, and then I found out he was totally full of shit. He was totally a liar, and he tricked me, and I'm a police detective for crying out loud. And he fooled everybody for years and years and years. He was going to reunions on D-Day and Normandy, and we figured out he was full of it. And, you know, he almost ruined me as a credible author and historian, but at the same time, I felt bad, and I understand why he lied and the horrible life he had. And, you know, he may be a liar, but he's my liar, you know, and I'm stuck with him. So it's you know, it's a good story. And, you know, that's someone I had to change his name in the book too, to not embarrass him or his family. And he's since passed away.
Well, you know, and I don't want you to, you know, give too much of the book away, but stories like that, I think are important, because I think we've probably all heard of stories of people back in that generation who lied in one way or another about something. And it may have just been they were, you know, 15, 16 years old, and they lied about their age in order to serve, right?
Yeah.
But this is the flip side to that. This is a different kind of lying. Someone who maybe didn't do the service that they claim that they did, a stolen valor situation, and they're now coming out, and now you realize that they're full of it. That's something that, again, it's a story that I don't think enough people recognizes even a thing that happens that much. But it does. And especially when you're talking about people from back then, where record keeping wasn't as good as it is now, where, you know, we have everything digitally recorded. So, you know, it's real easy to go just look up in a database somewhere, you know, someone's service records and all that kind of stuff. Back then it was, you know, basically a slip of paper that had your name on it. And this was your proof that you served. And so, you know, it doesn't necessarily exist in certain places that you might want to go look these things up. So much easier for people to do it back then. But yeah, you don't think about those types of things. So for me,
most of them, I know most of these guys back then definitely served in some sort of capacity, but they just completely embellished on what battles they were in, what units they served in, what they did, you know. And now I don't think they realize that, like, I can just pull all their records, you know. And sometimes records will tell a different story, where it's like you could have someone potentially that served in the 82nd Airborne and jumped into Sicily and jumped into Holland and was wounded, but then his final discharge says store clerk, 308th Quartermaster Battalion. But that's just because that's where they finished their service. That's the last unit they finished their service with, you know? So you really got to do a lot of
digging. And I know with my
because my
grandfather, he served in World War II. He was in the Navy. And I requested his service records to find out more about his service. He passed away when I was young. And I just, for education purposes, I wanted to learn a little bit more about where he served, what he did, all that kind of stuff. And it's a lot of searching through these records and a lot of connecting dots to figure out, you know, where he was. You know, he was at the Battle of Iwo Jima and, you know, all that stuff. But it's like you've got to dig through a lot of different records to be able to figure this stuff out. So you're absolutely right with all of the record keeping and everything like that goes into it. It's not an easy task to dig up all of that information. So we're going to take another quick commercial break. When we get back, we'll talk more about where you can go to find the book and how you can get involved and support these trips over to Europe. So stay tuned.
This message is from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Veterans can now get a free lifetime pass to U.S. national parks. Go to the National Park Service website, nps.gov.
So, Andy, really incredible work that you're doing, taking these veterans back to Europe, pairing them up with the Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, documenting their stories. All the stuff that you're doing, I think, is absolutely amazing. For the listeners who have been following along and they're interested in getting a copy of your books, where can they go to get a copy of your books or even to make a donation to help out some of these World War II veterans take that trip back to the battlefields that they once fought on or where they can go to get the information for that?
Sure. You can find The Rifle on Amazon, The Rifle. Just type in The Rifle and you'll see it. World War Stories of America's Last World War II Veterans Told Through an M1 Grand. The Rifle 1, The Rifle 2 is on Amazon. And then if you'd like to make a donation to my mission to bring more World War II veterans back before it's too late to Europe, you can find it at theworldwar2rifle.com. We have GoFundMe and we have PayPal. And then on Instagram, The Rifle, or Facebook, The Rifle, I guarantee you, if you make a donation, I will not let you down. You will see that I do produce and I will bring these guys back to where they
serve. Yeah, absolutely. And so I will have links to all of that in the show notes for the listeners who want to either get a copy of the book or either book. I know the second book, The Rifle 2, won't be out for a couple of weeks once when this episode comes out, but I'll have the link there, you know, as soon as it does come out. And I'll have links to where they can go to make donations to help some of these World War II veterans get back to the battlefields that they once fought on and make some memories for them. You know, hopefully good memories, but also to bring some closure in cases where maybe it's not the best of memories, and help them along the way that way. So, Andy, I really do appreciate you taking the time to join us and share these stories. You know, I think the work that you do is really incredible. You know, I hope that you continue doing this and getting more people out there to the battlefields that they once fought on.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show and being able to spread my whole awareness. Absolutely. To the mission.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Sun, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.